So good evening and welcome to lesson two of our course called My God. By the way, the words My God are actually a translation of two words in our prayers, which is a verse in Exodus in the song at the sea, Zeh Keli, which means My God. That's just an FYI. So great to see everybody back, even on this cold, rainy Houston day. And I'm excited, very excited to continue this course and to specifically discuss the topics that we will be talking about today, the questions that we'll be talking about today. Last week, we can say that we filled out the first page of the questionnaire about God. And today, perhaps we could say we're moving on to the second page. Last week, we talked about where he is, who and what God is, how he came to be. Just very generally, one idea, just to recap briefly, we talked about the fact that God, our perception of God, needs to first and foremost be deconstructed before we construct. We need to make sure that we don't put God in a box, that we don't create an image of God within our own perception. And we also said that God is totally beyond any definition or description. And just like you would not go to the hardware store to buy milk, right? The mind is just not the correct tool to try to approach God. We could have... Like we said last week, we will be discussing and learning a lot about God, but God himself is just not something that we can take with our mind. It's just the wrong tool. But now that we establish that, we will try to understand as much as we can about God, and that is the key. So this week, as I said, we're going to turn to page two, so to speak. And that is not, I don't mean that literally, by the way. I meant like page two in our questionnaire about God. Sorry to confuse. In fact, if you're looking for the page, we're going to be on like 38, I believe, in your student book. Or 37, something like that. So today we're going to be addressing questions like, does God have feelings? Does God communicate with human beings? Number three today will be, does God ever act illogically? Number four, why does God have so many names? And number five, what's up with the dash, that hyphenation in middle of the word God, when often you'll see a dash instead of the O? Hopefully we'll get to question five, because the first ones are going to be really fun. Okay, so with that, let's jump right in to question number one for today. Does God have feelings? How do you feel about that question? So, for many, this question seems to be a significant one. Why is that? Why would we be so concerned about God having feelings? That's because we are in, or we want to be, in a relationship with God. And to be in a relationship with someone where there's no feelings and everything is just theoretical and technical is not really a relationship. So that's a problem. Now, if we're in a relationship with God, we want to know if he has feelings. But based on what we learned last week, that God is totally removed and totally beyond it all, then I think the answer would be that he doesn't have feelings. And in fact, we're going to get there. In fact, we start with Maimonides in text number one, who takes this approach. And I'll start from my left side today. Nick, would you like to please read for us this teaching from Maimonides, from his Laws of the Fundamentals of the Torah, right in the beginning of his 14-volume work?
God experiences neither anger nor laughter, neither joy nor sadness. God says, I, God, have not changed. Now, were he to be at times enraged and at times elated, he would experience change. Rather, all these emotions are experienced by only those who inhabit bodies that are corporeal and therefore spiritually dark and lowly, who dwell in houses of clay, and whose foundation is the dust of the earth. By contrast, the Blessed One is elevated and exalted beyond all this.
Thank you. So, what would you conclude from Maimonides? That God has no feelings. Why is that? Besides for the fact that feelings are very much they're definable. And we established last week that God has no definition. That's number one. No definition should mean no feelings. Number two, feelings imply fluctuation, right? You ever heard of the term emotional roller coaster, mood swings? I can feel one way today, a different way tomorrow. I can feel one way this hour and a different way the next hour. If that's the case, how can we say that God, how can we attribute any of these things to God? Definition, fluctuation, and also God transcends time. If that's the case, he doesn't change. Now and 1,000 years are both combined in God's realm, in God's essence. If that's the case, again, God doesn't change. And to say that something fluctuating or that could change could be attributed to God is a problem. So that is as far as Maimonides is concerned. God has no feelings. And that's what seems to make sense, right? God has no feelings. Feelings are definable. God defies all definitions. And B, feelings imply fluctuations. God is unfluctuating. And this is the approach of Maimonides. Yes, Lou.
Is it written somewhere in my mind God needed people to worship him? That God needed the Jewish people to...
Yes, and that's a question for itself. Okay. Does God need, and God being vulnerable, so to speak? In fact, we may touch on it briefly even today. But yes, it's a very good point that you're bringing up.
So that's not necessarily a feeling. It was more a need than a feeling?
Correct. That's more need, and it will be addressed separately. Yeah. Right now, yes. So. In general, during the class, I'm going to take quick questions, okay. Not lengthy ones. These are good.
In Torah, God expresses love for children of Israel and also expresses anger at times.
Did you peek ahead?
No.
Just kidding.
No, but
excellent question. So that's on the other hand, right? On one hand, we have Maimonides, but on the other hand, text number two.
Okay.
Linda, please.
Bursting with that emotion?
Yes.
I will speak of God's kindness, God's praise, for all that he has bestowed upon us, abundant good for the house of Israel provided in accordance with his compassion and great kindness. God said, surely they are my nation, children who will be true to me, and he became their deliverer. In all their distress, he was distressed, and the angel of his presence saved them. In his love and mercy, he redeemed them. He bore and carried them for all eternity.
How many feelings could you extract from what you just read? Or anybody for that matter?
Kindness,
stress.
Yes.
Compassion.
Yes.
Mercy. Distress.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
Mercy.
You got them all. You got them all. So it seems like God does have feelings, as Lou noted just before. There's anger attributed to God in the Torah in various places. So how does this work out? Does God have feelings or does he not have feelings? So here we have from these sources, many passages throughout the Torah speak of God's feelings, both positive and negative feelings. So how does this work? So basically, picking up where we left off last week, what did we say? That sometimes we need to deconstruct before we construct. Or as some of maybe one or two of last week's answers, and this theme will be repeated during this course. A lot of the answers are going to be no, but yes. So no to the perception that we may have had up until now, but yes to a different perception of this particular, whatever the topic of discussion is. So here too, we're going to find something very similar. So human beings like us have feelings because we're dynamic, we're changing. And like we said before, we have emotions and people can feel one thing, feel another thing, and move in between feelings, and we change. This is true to say that God, of course, is incapable of fluctuation, change, and all that. That is all true when it comes to God's essence. So the no but yes is as follows. No, God in his essence does not have any feelings or any emotions. God totally transcends any type of definition, any type of feeling, or any type of change. Yet, God chose, while he is beyond definition, he chooses to create the world in general, and he also chooses to relate to the world with emotions and with feelings. So God is choosing to express himself or to utilize or to relate to the world with various different feelings. In fact, God actually created the world through his very emotions. As the next text, which is written by a student of the famed Kabbalist, the Ari Zal. He lived in northern Israel, in Tzfat. He's actually buried there. And his student, Rabbi Chaim Vital, wrote down his teachings. And there he says, text number 3 is from there. Shelley, please.
The world was created with the 7 divine attributes, beginning with chesed, kindness. They are kindness, discipline, compassion, perseverance, humility, connection, and sovereignty. The role of the divine attributes in creation is alluded to in the verse, I declare, let the world be built with kindness.
Thank you. So, God actually created the world with kindness. In fact, I'm not going to get into it right now, but in the 6 days of creation, each day, he used a different one of his emotions. Day number 1 was kindness. Kindness creates and bestows and gives. And God created light on day number 1. On day number 2, God created definition and created separation. That represents gevura, which is severity or discipline, and so on and so forth. So it's God's emotions and his feelings that he actually utilized to create the world. So this is a choice God made to relate to us with feelings. So you mentioned vulnerability before. So being vulnerable has a negative and a positive. Vulnerability is a negative because I'm vulnerable to if somebody, if I sell a certain product and if somebody may like what I sell or dislike what I sell. So I'm vulnerable to their decisions. So that could be a negative, that I would care of someone else's opinion of me, let's just say. But then there's also a positive to vulnerability, because when I'm vulnerable, I actually connect with others, etc. So God too, we could say God is vulnerable, but not in the negative sense of the word, but in the positive sense of the word. God, so to speak, chooses to make himself vulnerable so that he can enter into a relationship with us, which kind of touches on the need factor, but we'll discuss that more extensively during one of the other classes. So, yes, God's emotions do come into play when he relates to creation and to his created beings. And the only difference is that when it comes to God, unlike a human being, a person is very much, when we act with kindness. So for the most part, we are kind. Definitely much easier for us to be kind to someone that we like. Or if someone was kind to us, we're kind back to them. And that's normal. But let's just say when somebody is at their child's wedding, in a very joyous occasion, it's a very happy occasion, and you're just feeling very elated, and you're just feeling more broad than you typically do on a regular day. It's possible that at such an occasion that you would embrace someone you dislike, maybe even someone that you hate, and you would act kindly even towards such a person. Because it's like the essence of your soul is revealed at an occasion like this. That's what joy is. We know that joy breaks boundaries. Simcha poreh together. I just translated that from English back to Hebrew. So when someone is joyous, it breaks through boundaries. That's why joy is so essential to serving God, to being a Jew, especially in Hasidic life. Joy is key. If someone is like not joyous, it's like the worst sin, because joy is the key to everything positive. We're more open and we're more positive about everything. So the point I wanted to make was that on a normal day, we tend to act more limited with our kindness. And we're kind to those who are kind with us. God, however, is like always, his kindness is always emanating from his essence. So the way we would act, of course, it's just on human terms. The way we would act at our child's wedding, at a joyous occasion, and we would be kind to everyone, like infinite kindness, that's how God is always. Because God's attributes are infinite like he is infinite. And that's why when he gives and he bestows, it's also in an infinite way, just like he is. As opposed to us, we don't usually operate from our essential space. It takes a very special occasion for us to get there. On a regular day, we operate in a more finite way. God always operates infinite on an infinite level with his emotions. So one last point in this on this question. So number one, just to sum up what we just said. So we said that God himself is transcendent and unaffected. God himself, so the answer, this is the no part of the answer. Does God have feelings? Does God have emotions? The answer is that he himself is transcendent and unaffected. But God chooses to relate to the world, and that is where God's emotions come into play. When he creates the world, that's where his emotions start. And kindness is the starting point for all of creation and the bridge that connects us with others. So this is, as we noted in that verse from Psalms, Ki amarti olam chesed yibana. When God created the world, he used his attribute of kindness in order to do so, because that is where God's emotions begin. Now, one final point on this that the Baal Shem Tov taught on a verse of Psalms, also from Psalms, Psalm 121, where it says that God is like your shadow. Why would God be like our shadow? Because, do I have a shadow over here? A little bit. So, how does the shadow work? Whatever you are putting forward, that's exactly what's going to come back to you. I'm not sure exactly how, of course, people refer to this idea as karma typically. I'm not sure the origin of it. I didn't look it up. But we can say it's a Jewish concept or where karma comes from. What does that mean? God being our shadow, however we behave, we generate God's response in a similar way. So it's not just that God created the world with emotions, but God actually made it possible for us to trigger his emotions. So how God is going to behave towards us is going to be based on how we behave and what we put out there. That's what it means. God is our shadow. Hashem Tzilcha means that however I behave, God responds, just like your shadow responds to you. Just to give one illustration to this, by raise of hand, how many were at the Kotel in Jerusalem? Almost everyone. So, that's great. You weren't yet. March 2023. Just kidding. We're a different time. So, when you approach the Kotel, there's a very good chance that some people who were referred to as beggars may have approached you for charity. This is true in like Brooklyn, New York neighborhoods too. Every morning people are approaching people at synagogues. Now very often we tend to like get a little annoyed by people who are a little intrusive and you're just trying to do your thing. But think about it. Somebody is approaching you. We may okay, at best, maybe we'll give them some change or some money. But very often we just would kind of conveniently ignore them. But what are we doing when we approach the wall? We're turning to God to ask for things also. But moments before we do that, we're shrugging off somebody that turned to us in need. So you may have noticed that in our prayer book, in the very beginning of our morning prayers, before the formal part that we start when the service begins, there's one line there before our prayers. It says, I hereby take upon myself the commandment to love your fellow as yourself. Before we even start praying, we say that line, that I take upon myself this mitzvah. Why is it placed there? Why can't it be somewhere else? And the answer is because during prayer, we are coming to God to ask for our needs. The best thing that we can do before we do that is say to God that I am opening myself up to be united with everybody else around me. Because the greatest happiness and joy to a parent is when all their children get along. So we want to tell God, we want to, so to speak, impress God before we turn to ask for things and say that we are together with everybody else. We are accepting upon ourselves this mitzvah. In other words, we are putting forward this attribute of kindness. We are practicing kindness. We are committing to kindness. And in so doing, we have the power to generate God's emotional response in kind.
Can I ask a quick question? I know you'll sure. Want quick ones. The seven divine attributes, the seven listed, and how we always talk about, you know, made in God's image. I mean, isn't this basically, since God is not corporal, isn't this God's image? Could it be argued?
So God doesn't have an image. Exactly what we're saying. Yeah. God doesn't have an image, but He chooses to relate to the world with these attributes. Exactly right. And by the way, this is a Kabbalistic approach. In other words, Maimonides wrote from a more law approach, and that is that God doesn't have feelings. But the Kabbalistic approach is that is true on an essential level, but then where God does engage and relate to creation, he chooses to utilize these attributes and these emotions. Yes, Nick?
Since we're created in the image of God and we have a piece of him within us, does that act like a bridge to cause this action-reaction relationship?
The fact that God being like our shadow because we are so, we have a piece of him in us.
So that causes a bridge in a sense?
You could say so. Yeah, I think that would be a good thought. Okay. Yeah, I mean, it's really the bond that we have. It's like parent and child. So God and his children would... God basically empowered us to be able to do so. He gave us the ability to generate his emotional responses based on our behavior. Any other quick questions? All good. Okay, so with this, we come to the close of question number one for tonight. It's these feelings that keep the world in existence. And just as God is infinite, his attributes are also infinite. This means that God loves and cares for us infinitely. Whoever shows compassion for those who God has created, what's the continuation, will receive divine compassion in return. Okay, so how do we answer question number one? Does God have feelings? God essentially transcends feelings. That was the no, but yes, but chooses to relate to his creations with emotions. Okay, I think we are ready for the next exciting question for tonight. Does God communicate with human beings? Does God communicate with human beings? So this couple went to visit a marriage counselor. The therapist turns to both of them and says, "So what brings you here?" So she speaks first and says, "My husband never tells me that he loves me." So the therapist turns to the husband and says, "Why indeed is this the case?" And he turns to his wife and says, honey, we got married 28 years ago. And at the time, I told you that I love you. If anything changes, I'll let you know. So it's common knowledge that any relationship needs to have communication. Communication is essential to a relationship. So if we just establish that we are in a relationship with God, then the question becomes, does God communicate with us? Is there communication? So the most important element in a relationship is communication. Now, we know that we communicate with God during prayer. That's the time when we speak to God. The question is, does God communicate with us? Quick vote, yes or no? Raise your hand if you say yes. Raise your hand if you think that not. No takers. Okay, let's go to the next question. Just kidding. Let's work through this. So it seems that everyone is in agreement that yes, God communicates with us. The question is how? So there are various ways. So we're going to start with the first and foremost, where everything started, as far as communication to all of us. In text number 5, Heather, would you like to read that for us, please? It's some verses out of the book of Deuteronomy.
Ask now regarding the early days that were before you. Since the day that God created human beings upon the earth, had inquired from every people, from one end of the heavens to the other end of the heavens, to determine, was there ever an event of this magnitude, or has anything similar to it been heard of previously? Did ever a people hear God's voice speaking out of the midst of the fire, as you have heard, and remain alive?
Thank you. So what do we have here? We have the grand event of Revelation on Mount Sinai, some 3,300 plus years ago. God appeared before the entire nation of Israel, millions of men, women, and children, and directly addressed us in an event that had no precedent and that has not been repeated since. What happened at that occasion? God communicates the Ten Commandments, but that was followed by extensive communication to us. In fact, the entire Torah that we have, that we call the five books of Moses, are the communications of God to the Jewish people through Moses. Just by the way, as an aside, Judaism is the only religion that argues that God communicated to the nation in front of a mass audience. No other religion claims that God revealed himself to millions of people at the same time. So just as a side point. So let's go on to Maimonides, who wrote this some 8 centuries ago, one of the most venerated Jewish philosophers of all time, already quoted once tonight. This is the second one. And Maimonides famously distilled the Jewish belief system into 13 principles, 13 principles of faith. And here we're going to look at principle number 8. It's on page 44 in text number 6. Joyce, would you like to read that for us, please, if you're okay with that?
The 8th principle. The Torah is from heaven. We believe that this Torah that we currently possess is that which is given to us through Moses, and it is entirely from the mouth of the Almighty, meaning that it all came to Moses from the blessed God.
So this is where he articulates very clearly that a principle of the Jewish faith is that every word in the Torah was communicated by God to the Jewish people through Moses. And this also includes the oral law, by the way, because there are so many aspects to Judaism that we would not even know what to do or how to do them if it was just for the 5 books of Moses. I'll take an easy, obvious one, like wrapping tefillin. All it says in the Shema is that you should tie something as a sign on your arm and as totafot between your eyes. We don't know what that is. How do we know that it's a black box with parchments inside of it and what their shape should be and all the details and the color and everything? All of that was communicated to Moses. Moses, by the way, remained on the mountain. He went up to the mountain at the time of Revelation. We received the Ten Commandments, but Moses stayed up there for another 40 days and 40 nights, and that's when God communicated all the details. And Moses taught them to his student, to Joshua, and he to his student, and he to his. And this is how it reached us till today. That's why it's called the oral tradition. Yes, it's also written down. Eventually it was written down in the Mishnah, and the Talmud, and the Code of Jewish Law. But essentially, all of these details are called the oral tradition because that's how they were communicated. In fact, originally, the plan was that it should remain an oral tradition and it shouldn't even be written down. I'm talking about this part of the Torah. The five books of Moses are the written Torah. The oral tradition was meant to actually stay that way. But due to persecution, it became very risky that all these ideas and information would get lost. So that too was written down. So everything came from Moses, from God through Moses to the Jewish people. So, number one, we have the Ten Commandments to the entire nation. We have the written Torah through Moses, and we also have the oral Torah. All of that is God communicating to us what he wants from us. He gave us life. Everything that we, almost everything that we buy, certainly anything expensive, comes with a manual for how to use it. That's true about life as well. God gave us life, and he also gave us the Torah, which is a manual of how to live life, how to make the best out of life, how to live a functional, meaningful life. That's what the Torah is there for. And that was God's first and primary communication to all of us. That's number one. Okay? All right, next. Then we have what we call prophecy. Okay, so there was a one-time revelation of Torah on Mount Sinai. But then we have something called prophecy, and the same Maimonides continues in text number 7. Alan, would you like to please read that for us?
One of the foundations of our faith is the awareness that God confers prophecy upon humans.
Thank you. So Maimonides continues in his principles and says that it's a foundation of our faith that God confers prophecy upon humans. Now, prophecy can come in a variety of ways. God can ask someone or communicate a prophecy to a prophet that needs to be communicated to everybody, meaning a public message. And there are prophecies that are meant to stay private. Not everything was communicated to everybody. What we have in the books of the prophets are those prophecies that needed to be communicated to everybody, but not always is that the case. There are personal messages as well. So prophecy is the second method of how God communicates with the people. Now, by the way, why is prophecy such a fundamental principle? There are 13 principles of our faith, and prophecy is one of them. Why is it so essential to believe that God communicates to the people through the prophets? What if we remove that from our principles of faith? Why does that, how does it complete everything else that we believe? What if we didn't have that? And the answer is that this principle that God communicates in the form of prophecy, it negates a, perhaps we can say, an intuitive belief that people would attribute to God, to say that God is relegated to bigger things and more important things, or to kind of touch upon something we discussed last week, relegated to the heavens. To say that God communicates to people, if we would not believe that, it would be saying that God is limited to being transcendent. To say that God is transcendent is true, but to say that God is only transcendent is a problem, because then we're limiting God. We're saying that he has to be transcendent and he cannot be present. Let me just give you an example to make sense out of all this. So let's just say the President of the United States went to visit a classroom of children. Doesn't matter which president, okay? And he gave this class and gave this lesson to the children. So what would you say? Is this president childish because he spent time with kids in a classroom? No, you would probably say that he's actually super brilliant. Because if a president can only communicate with heads of state, then that actually means, okay, it's great that he's good at that, but it means he's actually limited to only communicating with people on his level. Somebody who has the brilliance and the skill to be able to take ideas that they know and distill them and to be able to communicate them even to a child means that they're even more brilliant. They're not limited to being transcendent, but they can also reach out to someone on a lower level than themselves. Just like the president or just like a teacher who can communicate to all ages. It actually means that they're more gifted and skilled to be able to do that. Similarly with God Almighty, to say that God does not communicate with people through prophecy would be limiting God to being transcendent. And we can't say that God is only transcendent. That would be saying that he's there and not here, or that he's limited to communicating with spiritual beings only and not with physical beings. This is why Maimonides says that it's a fundamental belief in Judaism to say that God communicates with humans through prophecy. Am I making sense? Are we good? Yes, okay. So, yes, Lou.
How do you define prophecy in this context?
How do you define prophecy? So, good question. Good question. The thing is that I'm not a prophet. Chabad is non for profit. Just kidding. So, how do you define prophecy? So, I can't tell you how a prophet experienced prophecy, but hold on to that question and to that thought, and we'll answer it shortly. So, that's number two. Private communications known as prophecy. There are communal messages that are communicated as a prophecy, and then there are personal messages as well. Now, like I said, what we just said is true about the prophets. The question, though, is, does God communicate not with prophets, but does God communicate with me? Or, for that matter, does God communicate with you? Does God communicate with any of us, even though we aren't an official prophet? So the answer to this, too, of course, is a yes. But we have to broaden our understanding a little bit of what it means that God communicates with us. Or what does God's communication even look like Lou just asked. So it doesn't have to mean that God communicates in this booming voice or through something, some transcendental experience. There's other more subtle ways of God communicating. And now we'll explore a form of God's subtle communication with each of us. Yes, Giancarlo.
So the fact that we wake up every morning, for me, that's communication already.
It is. It is, absolutely. And let's take that a little further. Let's go to text number 8a. Lucy, would you like to read? It's a short text from the Mishnah of Avot, chapter 6.
Each day a haggard voice issues from Mount Rebel's knife and proclaims, woe to the creatures who insult the Torah.
So there's a heavenly voice, thank you. There's a heavenly voice that issues forth from Mount Sinai every day. Basically like this wake-up call emerging daily from Mount Sinai. The problem with this statement is that Baal Shem Tov asks, and this is in text number 8b. Debbie, would you like to read that, please? It's on page 46. A to B.
Our sages state that a daily divine announcement warns against shaming the Torah. But if this proclamation remains unheard, then what purpose can it possibly serve? We cannot suggest that this announcement is audible to the human ear because that would contradict our own experience. Who can claim to hear heaven's proclamations, and which fool would believe individuals who claim that they do, instead of labeling them as false prophets? Therefore, if the announcement cannot affect positive change, what is the benefit of its issuance? However, this announcement does not involve actual words, for speech is a physical phenomenon, and there is no physical verbalization, nor are there audible sounds in heaven. Rather, the announcement is issued in the dimension of thought. These thoughts travel to humans on a daily basis and translate into seemingly spontaneous thoughts of repentance that are actually caused by the daily divine proclamation.
Thank you very much. So what are we saying here? What's the Baal Shem Tov teaching? So first he says, we have this voice emerging from Mount Sinai every day, but did you ever hear it? I haven't. So what's the point of the voice if we're not even hearing the voice? So what he explains is that the voice doesn't mean this loud booming voice from Mount Sinai. It means subtle, subliminal communications from God to each one of us in one way or another. So Giancarlo noted that waking up in the morning is God communicating with us. First of all, it is, because he's giving us a gift by waking up in the morning. And the gift of another day. That means he's exactly, Modani is our acknowledging that gift. God is telling us that you matter. I'm giving you another day because you have a mission here on earth. What happens during the day? Did you ever have a moment of inspiration that you can't really explain? Like it came out of nowhere, or just like a thought, you know, I want to do something good, I want to do something positive. You know what, I had an issue with that person, you just, one day, out of nowhere, you're just like, maybe I should reach out to them and kind of put it behind us. And you can't really explain where the thought came from. So the Baal Shem Tov is teaching us that these are God's way of communicating to us. Could we put our finger on it and say that God just spoke to me? Of course not, as we'll soon explain why that is. They're subliminal communications, but they definitely are coming from God. In fact, a woman once wrote a letter to the Rebbe saying that she's seeking guidance from God, and she wants to know how to get it. She feels like she needs specific guidance. The Rebbe wrote back a handwritten note, and I'll translate it into English. He wrote these words, God speaks directly to your soul, and these communications are behind your good resolutions. So when somebody takes upon themselves to do something good, it doesn't come from nowhere. It actually comes from the fact that God spoke directly to your soul. Did you know when it happened? Not necessarily. But the fact that you're moved suddenly to do something positive, it's because God is communicating directly to you. So this is like, obviously it's on a prophecy with bells and whistles, but this is God communicating to an individual. And God is orchestrating things, what we'll call them, to use modern day terminology, you know what targeted ads are, like on Facebook and Instagram? When you're getting ads, as you're scrolling down your page, these are targeted ads. They're actually put there because information was gathered about you, and the algorithms figured out that these are products that you would be interested in potentially. Certainly a greater chance than other things. So everything that we experience throughout our days, things that we see, things that we hear, people that we encounter, these are all, we'll call them targeted ads. God is putting them in our path, putting ideas that we need to hear, puts the messages in our path, the people, the things, and all of that together is considered communication from God. Yes, Larry.
This could be good and bad. Is that right?
No, I would say it's only good. God doesn't communicate bad things to people. If it's bad, it's coming from your evil inclination. Okay. If it's an urge to do something good, then it's God speaking to your soul to inspire you to go do something good. If we have a depressing thought, it's not from God. It's from our evil inclination or from our animal soul, the various terms that we've used in other courses. So, a Jew must believe that God communicates with individuals, with lowly human beings. So why does God communicate to people and lowly human beings? God is so great, he transcends transcendence, as we explained, but does God communicate with me? Our conscious minds don't hear his communications, but they speak to our subconscious. And that is what moves us to do something positive or something good. Listen, the fact that you had a thought, you know what, I think I'm going to attend this course. That may have been God speaking to your soul. And you were clever that you were paying attention. So, it's up to us to be mindful and listen to these messages. Let's take a look at the screen. Second, we have a sound issue. We have a sound issue. Where's the technician that we needed?
Without communication.
Nope.
It's probably a
traditional celebration, but his dad had also prepared. Danny was turning 13 in the winter of 1955. Like his classmates, Danny was gearing up for his bar mitzvah, the big day on which Jewish tradition places the full privilege and also responsibility of living the Jewish way on a young man's shoulders. Danny expected nothing more than a traditional celebration, but his dad had also prepared something quite different, a private audience with a world-famous Jewish sage, the Lubavitch Rebbe. The goal was simply to receive the great rabbi's blessing, but Danny was nervous. He was far more fluent in sports than Jewish studies, and having to face a genuine Hasidic master sounded intimidating. What if the rabbi would ask him about his Torah studies, or test his familiarity with the fine points of Jewish practice? But he didn't have to worry. When the Rebbe turned to Danny, he didn't ask a thing about his studies. In fact, his question was one that Danny never dreamt of hearing from a Torah sage. The Rebbe asked, "Are you a baseball fan?" Danny nodded enthusiastically, so the Rebbe took it further. "Are you a fan of the Yankees or the Dodgers?" Danny was most surprised, but hey, these were questions he could easily answer. He was a proud Dodgers fan, but the Rebbe was not done. "How was the last game you attended?" "Disappointing," Danny confessed. By the sixth inning, the Dodgers were losing 9-2. So we left. The Rebbe nodded. "Tell me, did the players also leave the game when you did?" "Of course not, Rabbi," Danny exclaimed. "Players can't leave in the middle of a game." "Why not?" smiled the Rebbe. "How does that work?" "Well, Rabbi, there are fans, like me and my dad. We just watch the game. And there are the players who actually play the game. We can leave whenever we want, but players have to continue trying to win the game until it is over." The Rebbe was waiting for this moment. "That's the lesson you should take for your life as a responsible Jew," he gently advised. "You can either be a fan or a player. Be a player." Well, Danny left that meeting with a new sense of purpose. He no longer viewed his bar mitzvah as a routine nod to an ancient tradition. No. It would be the starting pitch in a lifelong game he would play to win.
So the idea here was that the Rebbe decided to use an experience that this boy had as a message that he needed to hear from God Almighty. He was teaching him that everything we experience, everything we see, everything we hear, is there to teach us something and was put there in our path like this baseball game for this child. And I heard a colleague shared a story that happened to him last week, and I just feel compelled to share it. Rabbi in Port Washington, New York, he paid a shiva call last week. He went to the house and he left and he got into his car, but his car wouldn't start. And it was the first time in like 25 years that his car like died. Like it used to happen in his first few years when the cars he drove, you know, died, but not recently. So he didn't know what to do. He tried calling he drove all the way to Queens for this shiva call. Anyway, bottom line, he couldn't find any of these like Jewish community services called Chaverim and this or that to come help you. He just said, you know what, I'm leaving it here because he had to go back to a meeting. I'm just going to Uber back home and I'll figure out the car tomorrow. He calls an Uber. The guy gets out of the car and he tells him, I'm taking the Uber because my car died. He said, let me see what happened. He said, oh, all you need is jumper cables. So he goes to his car to get them. Then he realizes he didn't have them. He thought they were in his trunk. They were really at home. The driver tells him, I live 7 minutes from here. I'm going to go get them. So for whatever reason, he went with him. So he was driving with him to go get the cables and then to come back and to help his car. While they're driving, for some reason, this driver felt that he should utilize the opportunity to talk to this rabbi. And he opened up to him and shared with him that he's in a very good marriage for about 30 years and he has beautiful children, etc., etc. And he said that somehow, in some way, he fell into this relationship, a long-distance relationship with another woman. He knows it's damaging to his life, but he just doesn't know what to do about it. He's stuck in it. He can't get himself out of it. And it's like he has like a separate phone that he said. He showed the rabbi. He has a second phone in his car that he utilizes for this purpose. He knows it's destructive. He just doesn't know what to do. So the rabbi spoke to him while they were riding there and back. And he explained to him that he understands the struggle. You know, it's like an addict. You know that this bottle of alcohol could destroy your life, but you just are not able to put it down. But he spoke to him. He spoke to his heart for the time that they were together. And when they came back to the car to actually jump the car, the guy was very moved by the conversation. He took the second phone and he actually put it into the drain on the side of the street and dropped it in there. And right there, just brought an end to this sinful relationship that he fell into and was now resolved to get out of it. I share the story because everything is orchestrated from above. The fact that this car had to die, by the way, this guy was not Jewish, he was a Greek Gentile, the driver. The fact that he ended up in the car with him, the fact that he didn't have the cables, and that's why he had to drive with him, were all things that needed to happen and communications from God to that individual through this rabbi in this moment. So does God communicate with people? Absolutely. Does it come from this booming voice at Mount Sinai? Absolutely not. Not nowadays. Now it comes in the form of communications and targeted ads that reach us in various different ways. And the key is for us to be open to them. Final thought on this question of does God communicate with us? And that is, why is it that God chooses to communicate to us in this subtle, subliminal way? Why not speak to us clearly the way he used to speak to prophets? And the answer is that if God would speak to us in a very obvious way, he would basically rob us from our free choice. If in order to have a level playing field, God needs to conceal his communications to us. If it was so obvious that God was talking to us, we basically would always be doing the right thing. It would be game over. The whole point is that we're not sure. And that even with our children, when we want to communicate something to our children, I'm sure you can all relate to this. Sometimes, okay, maybe something needs to be said very clearly. But other times we speak to them in a subtle way because you want them to, you need to communicate it, but you also want them to come to the conclusion on their own. You don't want to just tell them outright and make it very obvious, and then basically they're doing it because you told them to do it. They didn't come to the conclusion on their own. God wants us to be able to contribute to the thought process and to the decision, not just make it obvious that he's saying X, Y, and Z to us, and then we basically have no choice but to be overwhelmed, so to speak, by God's communication, which doesn't allow us to choose otherwise. So that is the final thought on this topic. Why does God communicate in such an indirect manner? It would be too easy to do the right thing if God was speaking to us every day and telling us in a very obvious way what to do. Any quick questions on this topic? Okay, I guess we are good. So let's go on to the next one. So, where are we? I guess let's just sum it up. Does God communicate with human beings through the Torah? Yes, through the prophets, and even us subliminally. Okay. So next question for tonight, question number 3. Does God ever act illogically? Shift from one topic to the next. It's a very different one. But does God ever act illogically? So, it's quite obvious that a lot of things that we see in the world around us sometimes don't look very logical. Things happen in the world and you gotta wonder, what's God thinking? Was he thinking when this and this thing happened? Obviously, tragedies that don't make sense that we see. How does this fit into God's plan? Where's the logic to all of this? And by the way, we're not going to be treating the question of why do bad things happen to good people tonight. This is not what we're addressing now, although we touch on it, but that's going to be addressed in, I believe, the next class. And it's going to get a treatment in its own right. Here the question is, if God ever acts illogically, or is everything that God does very logical? So the simple answer to this question, does God ever act illogically? The answer is no. And God is always doing everything logically. But we just said that we look around the world and see so many things that don't make sense. So how do we explain that? So we explain it by saying that it doesn't make sense to us, but it makes sense to God. God is doing the logical thing. But just because it's logical doesn't always mean it's easy to understand. In fact, my iPhone was created by human beings. Some people know exactly how it works. I use it, but I have no clue how the system operates. Am I going to say that it's illogical just because I don't get it? No, I'm going to use it and I'm going to enjoy it, even though I know that someone does know exactly how this thing works. Similarly, with God's plan, I only see a very limited amount of, I only have access to a small amount of information. God knows the big picture, so it's clear in God's mind, it certainly is logical. Let's just read a very beautiful text on this topic by Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik. In text number 9, Giancarlo, would you like to read for us? It's on page 48. And
certainly the testimony of the Torah regarding creation, that it is very good, is true. However, this is only stated from the unbound perspective of the Creator. In man's finite, limited view, the absolute good in creation is not apparent. The contrast is striking and undeniable. To what might this situation be compared? To a person who views a beautiful tapestry, the work of a finite artisan, which contains woven into it, on its front, a representation dazzling to the eyes. To our great sorrow, we see this image, the world, from the observed side. Can such a sight become a sublime
aesthetic experience, though we are incapable of comprehending the panorama of reality without which one cannot uncover God's master plan, the essence of the work of the Holy One.
Thank you very much. There's something very, very profound being said here, that when you look at a tapestry, it may be beautiful and stunning on one side, but if you look at the other side, it's going to look like a mess. So oftentimes, when we look at the world, God sees it from the beautiful side, even though when we look at it, it looks like a mess. But it's just because we don't have access to the way things look on the other side. So does God always act logical? So answer number one to this question is yes. It just sometimes we don't understand God's logic. Were you ever watching a movie? Maybe you and someone else, and like a third person walks in, and whatever, a half hour into it, 45 minutes into it, and he sees something happening on the screen, and he's like, what's going on there? You know exactly why that person just went from this room to that room or whatever, because you saw from the beginning. So you know what the next move is. But the one that just walked in and doesn't have the information of the storyline that happened from the beginning till now, they just don't get it. And that's what our perspective and perception is when we look at things in the world. We don't see the big picture. God sees the whole picture. We see a very short amount of it, a very small piece of it. So when we look just at that, it looks like it makes no sense to us. But in God's mind, it's logical. So that's answer number one. Okay? So, although difficult to comprehend, there is logic behind it all, and God sees the larger picture. So that tells us that, yes, God does always act logical. Any quick questions on that? Okay. But now we're going to kind of take a different spin on this question. And, you know, for many of the questions so far, we were saying no, but yes, right? Here we're going to do a yes, but no. So far we said that does God always act logical? Yes, but not necessarily. There's an exception to this too. But it may not be exactly the illogical that we are thinking. So let's get into this a little bit. So let's look at an example of what it might mean for God to prioritize another value over logic. Okay, we're going to have a little fun here. We're going to read a passage from the Midrash. We're going to give it to Manny. Midrash Yalkut Shimoni. And what this is, basically, this is not, of course, actual conversation, but it's like an allegorical conversation between the Jewish people and several different entities. Of course, it's the way the sages would have proposed of how this particular entity would respond to the question. Go ahead.
Wisdom was asked, what should be the consequence for one who has sinned? And wisdom responded, evil pursues sins. That's from Proverbs 13. Prophecy was asked, what should be the consequence for one who has sinned? Prophecy responded, one who sins shall die. The Torah was asked, what should be the consequence for one who has sinned? The Torah responded, let them bring a guilt offering and they shall be forgiven. God was asked, what should be the consequence for one who has sinned? God responded, let them do tshuva and they will be forgiven. This is the meaning of the verse. God is good and just, and he therefore directs the sinners on the way, meaning that he shows sinners the path of tshuva.
Thank you. Let's unpack this here. So Hasidic philosophy explains this conversation like this. Each one of these four entities responded to the question based on its perspective, and we'll explain. So first and foremost, wisdom, the entity of wisdom was asked, what should happen to somebody who sins? What did wisdom say? Wisdom said, well, what happens when you eat poison? There's a negative result from it. You can't help that. When you sin, evil pursues you. It is what it is. That's just the natural, logical result. It is what it is. Okay, next entity. Prophecy was asked. Tell me, a person who sins, what should happen? Prophecy said, someone who sins should die. Why did prophecy answer that? Because what's the essence of prophecy? Prophecy means absolute devotion to God. Because that's how you could be a prophet. A prophet was a prophet only by being absolutely egoless and being a channel and a conduit to God's communications. So they had no ego. Total devotion to God. So if somebody sins, it means that they are very egotistical and very selfish. So basically, from the vantage point of prophecy, that person has no reason to exist. So the result of a sin is that they should at least have spiritual death. Next entity that was asked was the Torah. Torah was asked, the person who sins, what should happen? Okay, well, Torah has a system. Torah is the system where the laws exist. And this system says that if you break a law, there is a way to fix it. There's an undo button. And it gives you a way to do that. You bring a sacrifice, you bring an offering to the temple, and you could be forgiven. The fourth entity that was asked, what happens to a person who sins, that was God himself. And what did God say? That all you need to do is repent, and you are forgiven. So what does that mean? That God forgives us simply because he wants to, just because he loves us. So all the other mechanisms, even Torah itself, there needed to be a certain formula. You needed to do a certain thing in order to attain forgiveness, in order to win forgiveness. When it comes to God, God forgives unconditionally. So what does that mean? Is that rational? Does it make sense? No. The rational result of sin were the other responses, including wisdom itself was asked, what should happen to someone who sins? That sins. That's the rational response. God's response is totally irrational. So here we have an example of God, so to speak, being illogical. Even though it would be logical to say that someone who sins should be punished, God still says and takes the approach that someone who sins should be forgiven as long as they repent and they do teshuvah. So it's illogical to assume that God is logical. That was our first answer, because the one who created logic bound is the one who created logic bound by the rules that he created. So then we came to teshuvah. What does that mean? That our relationship with God is not mediated by any logic. The point here is that sometimes there's two different things. There's being irrational and being unreasonable. It could be that something is unreasonable, but it doesn't mean that it's also irrational. Meaning sometimes being irrational is actually a good thing. For example, you know, we just finished a weekend where we had a guest rabbi from Ukraine who spoke to us Friday night and Shabbat, etc. Now, he touched on this idea and we discussed it while he was here, how the vast majority of Jewish professionals and even rabbis of other organizations and synagogues left the country when this war began. The Chabad rabbis did what they had to do to bring their families to safety, but then they returned to tend to their communities. Let me ask you something. Does this make sense? No, it doesn't make sense. It's not the rational thing to do. The rational thing to do is that when there's a risk, you stay away. But was it a very noble thing to do that they sacrificed for their flock and are tending to the people that are remaining there and left behind and helping people and myriads of ways? Absolutely. So that is something irrational, doesn't make sense, but yet it's something that was necessary. Let me ask you this. Does it make sense when you have a business partner? So a business partner, a business relationship is a rational relationship. It's a transactional relationship. Does it make sense to be devoted to your business partner in an irrational way? No, it doesn't. But does it make sense to be devoted to your children in an irrational way?
Sometimes,
yeah. It's rational to be irrational when it comes to your love for your children, as an example. Why is that? Because the very nature of the love between a parent and child is an irrational thing. And you sacrificed yourself and you put yourself on the line for their sake, regardless of what it takes. It's not a transactional relationship. A child that would get the impression from a parent that they're only going to do something for them if they get something in return would be very hurtful to the child. Rather, we're devoted, heart and soul, no questions asked. It's unconditional. So in that case, being irrational is actually very rational. And this makes sense, and this is why God, who is our Father, responded in this way when asked, well, what should be the result of sin? And the response was that, don't worry, I've got your back. Because God loves us unconditionally. So here we have a scenario where God is actually acting, so to speak, illogical. But the irrational and illogical thing to do is actually the rational thing in this case. So, we're a little short on time, so I may not get, I may just communicate this without reading the text, you know what, this one's important. Let's read 11a. Erica, would you like to read that for us, please? It's a couple of verses from Exodus.
Moses pleaded, God, if I have found favor in your eyes, may you go in our midst, for they are a stiff-necked people. So pardon our wickedness and our sin, and take us to your inheritance.
Thank you. What does it mean that Moses is trying to get God to forgive the people, and he says that they're a stiff-necked people? Is that a very good argument? If you were a lawyer?
It's their nature, and you created them, and this is the way they are.
But it's not a very good argument to try to win forgiveness. What was Moses really saying? What he was really saying explains, I'm not going to read 11b, I'm just going to share it without the text. Feel free to read it later. So Rabbi Schneer Zalman of the Adi writes in the Tanya, what he meant to say is that God, yes, of course the Jews messed up. They messed up royally. But don't give up on them so quickly because they are a stiff-necked people, meaning they are not going to give up on you so quickly, so you don't give up on them so quickly. That's what he was saying. He was actually telling God that they have this amazing quality, that look, in 3,000 years from now, they're still going to be into you. It's 2,000 years since the destruction of the temple, and we're here trying to establish and strengthen our connection to God. Who would do that other than an irrational group of people called the Jews? So Moses was telling God that they have this amazing quality, that they're a stiff-necked people, and that they are going to stay committed to you through thick and through thin, regardless of what they experience. If that's the case, you reciprocate that commitment to them and you forgive them because they're in it for the long haul, believe me. So please do the same for them. In fact, it may have been, it was a Hasidic Rebbe who was in Israel like after the Holocaust, but then was leaving Israel, I think, to the States. And some of his students said, like, who are we going to go to for a blessing when you're gone? And he said, when you need a blessing, this is what you should do. Find a Jew who has a number on his arm and is wearing tefillin on that same arm. That's who you can go to for a blessing. Any Jew who has a number on his arm and is wrapping tefillin on that arm is your best source of blessing, because that is the definition of a stiff-necked people. Somebody who experienced that and yes, remained devoted and committed to God, that is something that's unmatched. And this is what Moses was saying to God. So yes, God acts illogically, so to speak, in his commitment to us, in his unconditional love to us. But that triggers that we should have that same unconditional commitment back to God Almighty. So irrational love, let's take a look here. It's irrational, but beautiful and reasonable love. So it may be irrational, but it certainly is reasonable. And as we just discussed, a stiff-necked people, a nation that will irrationally remain loyal to you, even when logic might tell us to do otherwise, we still remain committed to God. And that basically has the ability to shift our whole Jewish experience. Because many have the attitude when it comes to Judaism that it's like what we like to call checklist Judaism. They have these duties that they need to fulfill as a Jew, and they kind of do it and check it off, and then they fulfill their duty. That's not the right attitude when it comes to it, to a person toward God. It's not about fulfilling our duty. It's about unconditional love. In other words, I'm just going to use an example. Let's say the Torah says you should give 10% of your earnings to charity. So what happens after you give 10%? Do you say, well, I fulfilled my duty, my obligation is done, now I can just hang tight? Or, I love God. I don't have to do a mitzvah. I get to do a mitzvah. I'm going to go beyond the letter of the law. I'm going to show my commitment with unconditional love towards God Almighty, just like He shows to us. So we're going to behave in that illogical way, so to speak, because that's how God behaves towards us. Let's wrap up this question. Being connected to God is part of our identity. Our commitment to Him isn't limited to what is logical. Not all irrational behavior is harmful, and this insanity allows you to live out your highest values. Ignoring logical considerations that would hold you back. So does God ever act illogically? What are our answers? First and foremost, we said that God acts logically, but we may not understand His logic. That was the first answer. But then we went beyond that and we said that God acts illogically due to His close relationship with us. So it was a yes, but also a no. All right, any quick questions on this? All good?
When that Rebbe went back to the Ukraine, that wasn't illogical, that's his philosophy. That's the creed that Hasidic rabbis do.
It's reasonable to be irrational. That's what we just said. It's certainly irrational.
But
most people didn't.
It's their philosophy. It's their commitment.
It's they have a philosophy of being irrational. That's true. And that's exactly the point we were making, that all of us should adopt some of this and bring it into our Jewish experience. We all should act a little more irrational and go beyond what our obligation should call for. So yes, it's a philosophy of being irrational. Thank you, Linda. So I think we mentioned the town of Chelm last week, did we?
Yeah, we're the...
So let's visit them again.
Swift people live.
So there was somebody, a Chelmite, who walked over to somebody. He was walking down the street, and he stops a man, and he asks for the time. So the man looks at his watch, and he tells him, well, of course I could tell you the time. It's 4:00. And the Chelmite is scratching his head, and he says, this is really weird. I've been asking this question to people all day, and everybody gives me a different answer. What is going on here? So here our question is, why does God have so many names? Can anybody name any of God's names here? Can't we just figure out what His name is? 3, 4. That's exactly the same. Yeah. So we already had about 5 right here. Why do we get a different answer from everyone? I mean, all of us, imagine walking over to somebody and say, and asking, what's your name? And he starts telling you, well, when I'm in a good mood, it's Ben. When I'm in a bad mood, it's Harry. When it's...
Well, Peter Banana.
Yes, that's true. Sometimes we have endearing names for our loved ones. But generally speaking, we still have one name for everybody else. So what's the deal with God, and why does God have so many names? We're going to be a little bit brief with the fourth and fifth question tonight. We're going to get the main point out of it, and you are free to review the text after the class. We don't want to go overtime. So in text 12a on page 55, what do we say? I'm just going to read it. Elohim spoke to Moses and told him, I am, and I'm going to read this as Havaya. Havaya is going to be the way I'm going to be referring to God's primary name, the Tetragrammaton. Havaya. So again, Elohim, are you following what's going on here? Elohim spoke to Moses and told him, I am Havaya. That's like me telling you that I am Daniel. Let's check out the next text, 12b. I appeared to Abraham, this is God speaking, I appeared to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob as Kael Shakai, and I did not make myself known to them by my name Havaya. So can we keep track of what's going on here? We have Elohim, we have making himself known to the patriarchs with Kael Shakai, we have told Moses his name is Havaya. Why all these different names? Can't we just kind of hone in on one? Okay, maybe a second, a middle name, but like, why are there so many names? So the key here is this, and this does, by the way, go back to one of the teachings and verses we discussed last week, but I don't want to go back into it because we discussed a different angle last week. But it's God responding when Moses asked, when the people asked for your name, what should I tell them? So what did we say? He said in Hebrew, it's Eyeh Asher Eyeh. And again, we discussed one interpretation last week. Today, it's going to be a different one. What's the meaning of that response? I will be what I will be. What's the meaning? Karen, would you like to read for us, please, text 13 from the Midrash?
Okay. God responded to Moses. Eliha, Asher, Eliha. I will be what I will be. Exodus 3:14. Rabbi Abba bin Mamal explained, God told Moses, you are speaking to identify my name. My names reflect my actions, and I am therefore known at times as Kael Shakai, Tzvot Elohim, or how'd you pronounce that?
Yeah, I said Havaya for that name. Yeah.
Okay, when I judge my creations, I am called Elohim. When I wage war against evildoers, I am called Tzvot. When I suspend the retribution individuals deserve for their sins, I am called Kel Shekai.
Yeah, it, even that, by the way, that name has a different letter so that we don't actually pronounce it. So it gets a little confusing with the names.
And when I act compassionately with my world, I am called
Havaya once again.
Havaya.
Thank you, Karen. So how exactly is all of this helpful? We just said that basically God's saying, when I'm this, when I act, when I do one thing, I'm called by this name. When I act another way, I'm identified by a different name. What is going on here? So, in short, God is saying, my names reflect my actions. What is he saying? What he's telling Moses is this: I have no name. So again, it's a no, but yes. Does God have a name? Of course not. A name, like we said before, is a definition.
It's limiting.
And God himself, in his essence, is totally beyond any such concept. The most that created beings can do to identify me, God is saying to Moses, is to describe the various ways that I interact with creation. When I interact with creation, then I assume a certain name. And when I'm kind, I have one name. When I'm strict or being disciplined or acting with discipline, it's a different name, and so on and so forth. So this is why God has many names, not because He is many. He is transcendent. He has many names because he behaves in many different ways. And each behavior or action has him being called in a different way. In other words, God himself has no name. Like, imagine calling to another person. You just say, hey, you. That is really what you would say to God himself. It's just you. No name. But when God is doing something, then he takes on a certain name. Similar to what we said earlier about God's feelings. So it's when God is engaging or relating, then he takes on a certain name. So there's a lot of information here, by the way, in your book on page 58, etc., about the names, the meaning of the names. I would highly recommend that you take a look at it after. I want to close this question with one more thought, and that is that we may not be paying attention, but we often say blessings. How does a blessing go? Just the average blessing over a mitzvah or a food. Baruch, atah. Pause right there. Right over there, we said we identified almost three names. The first thing we said is, you can actually look in figure 2.3 on page 62. It will be helpful. The first thing we said is Baruch, which means blessed. But Baruch doesn't just mean blessed. What does it mean? You're blessing God? Like God needs a blessing? Is he lacking something that you're going to go give him? So actually, the word Baruch also means to draw down. When you are saying a blessing over a mitzvah or over a food that you're about to eat, the hamotzi or whatever, this is what you're saying. You're saying, Baruch, I intend to draw down. What are you drawing down? The next word is atah. We start with you. That's God's essence. That's beyond any name. Then we say Havaya, which I'm reading from this page here. God's primary name that connotes his role as the transcendent and timeless creator of all that exists. Then we go to another name, Elokeinu. Elokeinu is the way God manifests himself and applies himself and invests himself in creation. So you see what's going on here when we're just saying an innocent blessing? We're drawing down God's essence to manifest itself and be revealed so that God should engage and relate to creation and then King of the universe. So we start from the very transcendent, the very essential, bringing him down all the way, so to speak, to our own reality. So it describes God's essence being drawn into the world. That's what we're doing when we're saying a blessing. Did you ever think about how profound the meaning of those words are when we're just saying a blessing over some food? So why does God have so many names? I'm going to wrap it up here so that I want to do question 5, but we'll do it very quickly as well. So God has all these different names. What's the meaning of it? Why are they necessary? God himself is beyond names. In order for created beings to identify with God, we describe God based on our interactions, which is why there are so many. And we just said in the blessing, we seek to draw down God's essence, the transcendent creator who invests himself into nature, into our world and individual lives. That is the deeper meaning of the very words we are reciting when we say a blessing. So, why does God have so many names? God is nameless. By the way, a friend of ours has gave us a vacation home that we went to a couple times in Austin. It's called Lago Vista. On the way down there's a road that we pass, and the kids love passing the road. It's called Nameless Road. So God himself is nameless, just like that street. His many names refer to his interactions with creation. That's when he picks up names. Final question, very quickly, what's up with the hyphenation of God? Why don't we write out the word God? Why do we put a dash instead of an O? So, in very short, you know what? I'm just going to go through the slides and try to figure it out from there. So, first of all, it's important to always mention God when speaking. When someone says to another person, how are you? What are you supposed to say? Thank God. Baruch Hashem. Of course you say, thank God I'm doing well, etc. Why do we say thank God? So it's a Jewish thing because we want God on our tongue. And it actually comes from our forefather Isaac, who identified Jacob as someone who God's name is frequently on his tongue. So it's actually a Jewish value. The Baal Shem Tov made it his life's mission to teach people to answer, thank God, when you asked, how are you? So that people are mentioning God. So it's important to always mention God when speaking. The Greeks enacted a ban on the constant referral to God. This is in the Hanukkah story. We now have the holiday, but before we got the holiday, when they were still trying to kill us, before we got the Hamantashen, the latkes and the donuts, wrong holiday. Before we actually got the foods, during the struggle, they actually put a ban on mentioning God's name. So what happened after that? The Hasmoneans fought back, and they instituted that people should mention God in speech and now in writing too. That people should write out God's name whenever you're writing something or a letter to another person. But not everyone was happy about that. The sages were against this new practice. Why would they be against mentioning God's name? Because when people started to write God's name all over the place, then the papers or whatever they were writing on started to end up being wasted and destroyed, and God's name was being mistreated. So they actually stopped people from writing out God's name on paper. So God's name, little idea here to make this point. Actually, in the 1980s, there was a story in Texas, right? In Dallas, Texas, with Gregory Johnson, who burned an American flag. And he actually got, he was sentenced to a year in prison. Not going to get into all the details relating to that right now. But after that, there was a Supreme Court decision that they would not be sentencing people for such things after that. But the decision is not relevant. What is relevant is that both sides understood that there is a dignified way of how to treat an American flag. And that in the law that was written up afterwards, it actually said that even when you have to throw a flag in the garbage, they used the words, you should discard of it in a dignified manner. Just about an American flag, even though it's just a piece of polyester and with some red, blue, and white on it. But it's not only that. It actually has meaning. It has significance. If that's true about a flag, most certainly about God's name. And this is why the sages instituted that we should treat it with respect. That's why we try not to say, to utter God's name. Of course, one of the Ten Commandments is not to say God's name in vain. But we extend that to not mentioning God's name in general unless it's necessary. And in writing, if you're writing down God's name, because that piece of paper could end up in the garbage, so we switch out the O for a dash, and that's a way of treating God's name with a greater measure of honor and reverence. So don't erase God's name. That's actually a prohibition. If you wrote it, even with a pencil, you can't erase it afterwards. Which is why the sages wanted to avoid writing God's name on all documents. So this is why we have the hyphen. It's a tiny mark, but it demonstrates our respect for the Creator. I just want to close with this thought that you would think, you know, it really empowers us and tells us how significant every action of ours actually is. If I'm just sitting with a pen and a paper and I'm writing God's name, when I write God's name, let's say not with the hyphen, but I write it out, I actually, me, little human being, I just actually created something that's sacred. And I now can't erase God's name. It means that our actions are really powerful, and everything that we do is so significant, even just writing out God's name to the extent that we can't erase it afterwards. So that should really empower us to know that everything we do has tremendous amount of significance. And we will close with the overview of tonight's class.
Can I ask just a quick question about
his nature?
Do you hold it till right after?
One. Please, God is, by definition, beyond feelings. Nevertheless, God chose to create the world.